Hello and welcome to episode 16 of the SRA podcast. This is your host, Alex Humva, back and ready for yet another week in the hell world. I am just super energetic tonight because I have just gotten off of an invigorating conference call, because all conference calls are just invigorating, the details of which are neither here nor there. But joining me for not only the conference call, but also for tonight is recurring guest slash co-host guest slash fellow denizen of the hell world, Faye.
Hello, everyone.
So we are back to tackle the news, and there's a lot of news. Unfortunately, the term hell world is almost inadequate nowadays to describe what we seem to be descending into. So we'll start it off on a lighter note, I guess. And then we'll dive just into the shittiest parts of our modern-day existence here in America. So, making its triumphant return, it was on a hiatus for, you know, a couple episodes. There was some news that came out here and there, but I just wasn't feeling it. Making its triumphant return is, of course, Elon Musk, frequent guest on the show, in spirit, as it were. That we love to take a look at Elon Musk and see what's going on. And, you know, sometimes I have to reach for a justification of why to talk about Elon Musk on the Leftist podcast, and sometimes I don't because it's my podcast and I'll do whatever the hell I want. But this week we actually have a good segment because Elon Musk, he is not taking the descent to hell world very well. He's back on his shit. So we will take a look to see what old elongated muskrat is up to. First things first, I guess he went on his Twitter and he was like, I don't want to be president anymore or chief executive officer anymore of Tesla. I'm still going to, you know, be the chief executive officer of Tesla. I'm still going to get my benefits and my stock options, but I don't want to be attached to the titles. Aren't titles just an old fashioned sort of thing? Like, they're like labels. No, we shouldn't be labeling ourselves. We should be free to do what we want. So he removed all of his titles. And, I mean, it was just childish bull, basically.
So, he removed his titles, but all he really did was just take them off the website and, like, his, like, social media, which doesn't really do anything. And no one noticed because no one cares. No one's checking that. It's not official. It doesn't matter. So a week later, he made his tweet. He's like, oh, I guess I don't need titles after all. And a few hours later, he's like, oh, well, I guess technically companies legally have to have a president, secretary, and treasurer. So I guess I have to have some title. Like, fucking really? Like, either he didn't know that and he's an idiot, or he's just playing it up his fucking Twitter personality for laughs, which I think is probably the case. But yeah, of course a business needs a president. It's like a legal requirement. I mean, we know that now with the SRA being a nonprofit. We've gone through this process. There's strict legal requirements on, you know, the offices that need to be filled in a company, or else the IRS or the government will just be like, what the hell are you doing? So, but the most offensive thing to me, you know, this is pretty weak sauce by Elon standards. You know, he's gotten up to much crazier hijinks before. But what really got my goat was this article on QZ.com. Now, QZ is an awful website, and no one should ever visit it, but it popped up in my news feed. And basically, they're saying that job titles are old-fashioned and obsolete, and Elon Musk proved that. And we should do away with job titles in information jobs, by which they mean bourgeois jobs for people that they think matter. And everyone should just be a project manager. That's all anyone is these days. We're project managers. Here's a project. Fix it. Here, you know, here's a project. Finish it. And we don't need these titles. Our roles in these companies should be completely fungible and interchangeable. And we don't need this, you know, strict organizational setup, which would be nice if they were approaching it from an anarchist horizontalist perspective. But you know that they aren't. Companies in America are built along strict hierarchical lines. You know, there are very few exceptions. Even the companies that try to claim that they're non-hierarchical, like Valve, who runs Steam, and they, you know, they're keeping Half-Life 3 in that vault somewhere. They claim to have a horizontal, very flat structure to their organization, but it's bullshit. Gabe Newell is still in charge of everything. his close friends and oldest employees are still the managers that direct everyone else's activity. Getting rid of job titles, all that does is disempower the middle-class petty bourgeois workers who are underneath the real bourgeois owners of the businesses. And by removing their job titles, it allows the owners of the businesses to dictate to their servants to do whatever the boss wants of them, basically. It's basically just a way of removing yet more accountability from the people who own these businesses and removing the legal contractual basis of a job description.
Pretty much. I like to quote this part from the end of the article that it says, one member of the conference audience asked Martin if his vision wasn't a recipe for chaos. His response, in a nutshell, companies already operate in chaos. They're sprawling and multi-layered. Communications break down between levels and departments. Strategy becomes meaningless. In Martin's vision, top leadership would still exist for the purpose of serving as captains of a company's overall direction, and one of the most important people in the company would be something like a chief operating officer who would assign individuals and budgets and specific projects. This person would have to know how to maintain the right pace and understand who is particularly adept in which roles. But even in this world, he noted, a company would still need a CEO, the ultimate decision maker, whose portfolio would be stuffed with the most meaningful high-level projects. So just taking that immediately, as somebody who worked in a international company, a particularly large European company, actually, that works here across the world, but here in America as well, that this is missing the forest for the trees. Yes, there's chaos in the corporate world. Anyone who's worked in the corporate world knows there's chaos in the corporate world. It doesn't mean that the hierarchy isn't there. Just because the lower levels kind of intermingle and cause chaos amongst themselves doesn't mean that there still isn't a strict pecking order. Just because me in my little corner of the warehouse could get away with certain things at my low-level position, and then my boss could get away with certain things, and his boss could get away with certain things, and their boss could get away with certain things, that's not chaos in the traditional sense. That doesn't mean that there's no leadership. That just means that there's certain things that the boss above you doesn't care about. That's all that means. It doesn't mean that you are an entity of chaos and disorder, and that companies already are in this position. No, companies are very hierarchical. The boss can still fire the people below him, and the people above him can fire him. And I say him because, unfortunately, in the supervisory positions, it's almost always a him. This is one of those shitty parts of the world, too.
I've never had a female boss.
Exactly. I mean, they exist. The liberals tell me they exist, but the only places I've really had a female supervisor above me was fast food, and that is one of the exceptions, because you'll find that low-paying, traditionally non-skilled, quote-unquote, supervisory work is something that ends up being filled with women a lot more, because that's where people get funneled. Because positions actually deserving of your skill level don't accept you. So now you're a supervisor at Spangles.
Before we move on to address more on the topic of sexism, I just think it's worth noting that if chaos is such a big problem at large corporations, maybe they should hire Jordan Peterson to fix everything.
Jordan Peterson is something we could just talk about for days.
We should have a Jordan Peterson episode.
I wholeheartedly agree. So look forward to that, patrons. We might be doing that here in the near future, just for the giggles. But yes, unfortunately, this terrible transition of ours is transitioning into yet another topic of sexism and transphobia and general appropriation of other people's spaces and cultures that they have developed, as well as just frat boyism, as it might as well be described as. Elon Musk, in the continuing segment that is the elongated Muskrat segment, because that's how it goes. Musk was replying to an individual. Let me pull up the tweet here on my screen. So, James Landino, I don't know who James Landino is. If people know who he is, feel free to fill me in. I'm not clicking on his profile page because I'm just too lazy right now. He added Elon Musk and said, show us your Bowsette cosplay.
And it's Elon Musk. It's just Bowsette.
Damn it. Anyways, Musk said, I'm actually a cat girl. Here's a selfie right now. And he proceeded to post a picture of a werewolf. So, fantastic, Elon. You failed on the first hurdle, but also you failed life. But then again, who am I to say he fails at life? He has $70 billion in net worth, and I have $7 in my bank account. I think obviously, as the anarchist capitalists would tell me, he knows better than me. But, I mean, I can talk about this, but I also play off of people better, and Faye's got plenty of thoughts on this, so I will let Faye begin.
I'm ready to go off on this shit. Catgirls are trans culture, and Elon Musk is appropriating my culture. All right? So, I have some shit to say about catgirls, completely aside from Elon Musk, because, really, he's just, you know, I don't know if he's on LSD or not. Azealia Banks makes shit up sometimes. But whatever it is, catgirls are a trans culture thing. If you've been on any part of the trans online community, you've probably seen it. If you go to r/trans with however many A's and N's it has, half the memes are catgirls. You know, you go on Tumblr, there's catgirls. You go on, you know, any trans Discord, it's full of catgirls. I want to call out a certain segment of the leftist community, and I've run into this in a few places, once in real life, you know, a couple times on like Twitter or Discord or wherever, but there's certain tendencies who know who they are, and certain communities who know who they are, who I think have an extremely bad take on trans women and the catgirl culture phenomenon anime thing. So the take that I've heard from these so-called communists is that catgirls are an inherently sexist and misogynistic cultural icon, and that they are demeaning to women, and that trans women who partake in this culture are being extremely problematic and bad because they're being sexist towards women by using this imagery. So, but oftentimes these characters are highly sexualized. You know, they're young, you know, teen age, maybe girls. You know, there's very much a sort of overlap into this sort of ecchi culture, or however you say it, which is very gross and not okay. And so because of that association, when people see folks using this imagery in really an empowering way, it comes across as very strange. It comes across as perverted. It plays into the perception of trans women as being, you know, male sex perverts, the sort of TERF view of trans women's sexuality. And so you get these very negative connotations to it. And so people are very quick to, you know, call it problematic, very quick to call it bad. But I want to speak in defense of the trans community here and of all my trans sisters. And I want to say that not only have catgirls been claimed by the trans community, but they're actually a very important part of many trans women's experience coming to terms with themselves. So, with that said, you ready, ladies? Break out the butler and Julia Serrano, because it's time to talk gender theory. Just a note here, this discussion will be mostly about trans women, because that is mostly the community in which this is relevant. So I don't intend to erase any trans masculine or non-binary identities by doing this. I just want to discuss this as it relates to transgender women. So what is gender? Who the fuck knows? So basically, trans women are raised as men. Some are aware from a very young age that they are trans and that they are female, and they know it from a very young age. But many trans women, possibly a majority, are not. They don't realize it until they're in their teens or 20s or even later in life. Some people have come out of the closet when they were 70 or 80 years old. When someone comes out later in life, they're often burdened with the marks of their male upbringing. Now, some people are going to bristle at this already because it sounds a lot like a certain TERF talking point, what they call male socialization. So the idea spread by TERFs is that, you know, while trans women may identify as women and they may, you know, present themselves as women, they were raised as men and they have certain indelible ideologies imprinted into them by their upbringing. And so they will always have this sexist male view on the world. So they can never truly be considered women in a psychological sense and must be treated as perverted men. Where this comes from is from what's called the social construction of gender, which is a theory primarily developed by feminist theorist Judith Butler. And basically, the idea there is that gender is a performance. It's the act that you put on, and you learn it as you are raised. And basically, you know, like you wake up in the morning and there are certain things that you do, and you go out into the world and there are certain ways that you act and certain ways that you interact with other people that are socially coded. And you've been taught to behave in these certain ways all your life. And so when you act in those ways, you are essentially performing a series of social rituals and behaviors which have been taught to you. Basically, the idea is that gender is entirely derived from your upbringing rather than some inherent nature. However, this theory has been disproved by the case of David Raymer, or Reimer, or however you say it, who was a Canadian boy who was born in 1965 and was accidentally maimed during his circumcision, and his genitals were no longer in what the doctors considered an acceptable condition. So the doctors made the executive decision to perform a vaginoplasty and give David Reimer a vagina and a vulva, and decided to raise him as a woman and give him hormones, essentially treating him as an unwilling trans woman. And the idea was that these doctors were influenced by Judith Butler. The idea was that being raised as a girl from almost birth, David Reimer would learn would learn the social role of a woman and would learn the social construction of gender and would perform that gender and would be a woman for all intents and purposes. But what happened is that David developed severe depression and severe dissatisfaction with his body. And I'm intentionally using his, you know, preferred name and pronouns here. In his teenage years, he realized that he was not born a woman and that he had a male, gender identity. And he transitioned back to being a man at the age of 15. He was raised as a woman, raised with all the social conditions of a woman, treated as a girl since birth. But he knew that he was not a woman. He knew that he was a man. And because of this, we know that there is some aspect of our brain or our psyche or our soul, if you believe in that, that there is some part of us that inherently embodies our gender identity that is separate from the social roles that we learn growing up. So because of this, we know that the social construction of gender is false. We know that people's gender is not determined by how they're raised. It's some internal aspect of themselves that embodies their gender identity. And just a side note, the story of David Reimer, of course, did not end well. He committed suicide because of the experience of dysphoria, of living in the wrong body and with the wrong social role, you know, of being perceived as a woman when he was in fact a man. And this is an experience that he shared with the trans community. So TERFs use the social construction of gender to criticize trans women and say that they are not actually female because they were raised as men and therefore they have male socialization. And obviously this is false, but there is the truth that there are aspects of gender that are performative, and there are aspects of our gender that are learned behaviors. Even though our gender identity may be inherent to us, we still need to learn the behaviors associated with that identity. And so because of this, trans women who transition later in their life, whether teenage years or on, they haven't learned how to behave as a girl. They haven't had a girlhood in, you know, most instances. You know, most trans women are subjected to a male upbringing. And this also is another reason why male socialization is not a accurate theory for trans women's behavior, is that trans women's socialization is different from cis male socialization, because a cis man has a male gender identity and is receptive to learning the social role of a man. A trans woman who is taught from birth the social performance of manhood will you know, typically be very unhappy with it. That's really what dysphoria is. Many trans women are upset with their bodies, but most of us are equally uncomfortable with at least some of the social roles associated with manhood, with being a man. And so because of this, while you know, you may be taught the same experience, you may go through the same experiences, you may hang around with guys all the time, you may learn, you know, guy culture and everything, you're going to have an experience that's different because you will be alienated from the gender being taught to you. You are alienated from your gender role, which causes dysphoria and dissatisfaction and discomfort with your life. And having a negative experience towards learning a male gender role is fundamentally different than growing up with it being a good fit for you. Because trans women grow up with this alienated gender experience, they have the gender identity of a woman, but they have the social upbringing of a man. When trans women first transition, they don't really know how to perform womanhood. They don't really know how to embody the social role of a woman. The only reference they have is the male gaze. Because they were raised male, and furthermore, because the male gaze is the standard lens through which our society views itself in movies and culture, that is the vision that trans women apply to themselves. So what is the male gaze? The male gaze is the perspective, you know, that the average, philosophically average, typical man uses to view the world that we live in. The male gaze typically involves sexualization of women. It typically involves the escalation of male empowerment. It typically means, you know, a focus on things of interest to men. You know, you'll find that there are differences in the ways that men and women are framed or shot in movies, the way that the angles and the lighting used on them in paintings and photos are different because we view these two different types of bodies, male bodies and female bodies, in different ways through the lens of male sexuality and male sexualization of the average heterosexual male towards women. And because this is the default societal viewpoint, and because trans women are raised as men, they typically have a very powerful male gaze that takes quite a bit of time living as a woman to overcome. Because of this, many trans women dive directly into, you know, certain superficial, highly visible, and often kind of teenage, you know, sort of cringy sort of ways of acting of certain subcultures that they can find some sense of femininity in. So one of the easy options that the male gaze offers people for viewing themselves in a feminine light is by acting cute, because cuteness is associated with femininity. And if you don't know how to be feminine, being cute is a good shorthand for that. And because of that, you have, you know, through the popularization of anime, you have this exposure to catgirls, you know, now that we're finally getting back to the point. Catgirls are made to be cute. You know, they have cute faces and the cute pointy ears and everything else, and it's very much a cute sort of things. In some cases, when Japanese culture sexualizes catgirls, as they sexualize almost everything, obviously, the catgirl trope, the character archetype, gets dragged into it as well with things like harem animes and, you know, all those sort of cringy, awful parts of that subculture that people disapprove of, and often for good reason. But not all catgirls are used in that context by a long shot. Most of them are just standard cute characters in animes. And so you get a bunch of trans women who grew up watching anime because they are alienated from popular culture. When they transition in their teens or in their 20s or whenever they do it, they look at the culture that they've grown up with, they look at what's readily available to them to seem feminine and to seem cute. And catgirls are a good place to start, I suppose, because really all you need to do is put on a pair of cat ears and meow occasionally, and you can act cute in the safety of your home, interacting with, you know, people who you're close friends with or whatever. And you can explore the role of being feminine without having to worry about behaving like a woman is expected to in public. It's essentially training wheels for gender. And so, of course, it also lends itself well to meme making, which helps it expand to more people. It's, you know, it's very much a sort of cultural phenomenon that's occurred. And I really don't think that that is demeaning to women in any way, because while it is being used, while cuteness is being used as a shorthand for femininity, and even though this is being used as a stepping stone away from the male gaze, that's still better than viewing themselves through the male gaze or trying to dive straight into womanhood without knowing what they're doing. Essentially, having these sorts of this sort of iconography, whether it's catgirls, wolf girls, or Bowsette, or other, you know, fictional characters that are portrayed as cute and that people may cosplay as or identify with through a meme or something, that's training wheels for gender. And I think it really helps a lot of women having the space to be able to do that. So when you get, going back to the so-called communists, when you get people who decry this sort of behavior as being sexist or being perverted or being sexually motivated, what they're doing is they're projecting the psychosexual desires and tendencies of a man onto trans women who are in the early stages of their transition from malehood to femalehood, from male gender performance to female gender performance, and they're judging them on the basis of how that looks to a man through the male gaze. They're using the male gaze to criticize the sexual connotations of a behavior being engaged in by women, and specifically by trans women. And I think it's fundamentally transmisogynistic and cis-sexist, because this sort of behavior is not judged to the same degree when performed by cis women. You know, we're recording this on Halloween, and when I got to the office today, there were three girls wearing cat ears. Cis women don't get shit for putting on cat ears to be cute, and trans women do. And honestly, I don't know what could be clear evidence of a bias against trans women in that case. So catgirls for trans women are not problematic. They're maybe problematic in origin, but I think most of the criticism levied against them are assuming a male perspective for the trans woman who is performing this, when really they're in the process of learning a female gender performance to match their gender identity, which is a delicate place in the time of someone's psychological development. And being dicks to people about that is not only not cool, but potentially damaging and could cause, you know, long-term distrust of that person's entire sort of view on the world, you know? So maybe that's why there aren't as many trans girl tankies around. Just a thought. And that's all I have to say on that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot. And I mean, admittedly, I'm not in the best position to talk about this, that my situation on this and is not a story for here nor later, but it's one of those situations that even coming from it from a more outside perspective, it's one of those things that Musk used it as a joke, and what it comes down to is that he is a wealthy, to the best of my knowledge, cis male, and he's using it as a joke with his friends, I guess, in a very public setting at that. This isn't like behind closed doors having a secretive laugh. This is in a public setting. And it's the sort of thing that there's a lot of history, and there's a lot of theory, and there's a lot of analysis that we can do on this. At the end of the day, it is the sort of thing that Musk is being a colossal dick, and he is using something that others are able to use and incorporate into their fandom and their stress relief mechanisms, basically, their coping mechanisms to help themselves, and it's just being made fun of as a childish joke, essentially. This isn't some big thing on Musk's part of, you know, secretly telling the world that he's a furry, I guess, but or trans. I don't think so.
No, and it's probably more in popular culture, it's probably more associated with the furry community, although I usually see them go in other directions. But I don't know, I don't think he's specifically making a jab at trans women. I think he's just jumping onto a internet meme that he saw somewhere and didn't understand where it was coming from. And I think that he's not necessarily malicious in this case. He's just kind of a fucking idiot. He's just an idiot. Why is he doing this on his Twitter account? He has $20 billion. Why is he posting catgirl or cat or wolf girl photos on Twitter? I don't understand, but I guess he just has a pathological need for attention.
I just realized I said 70 billion earlier, so now all the ANCAPs are going to come out and tell me how much of an idiot I am. That, you know, we're talking about Musk being an idiot for using a bad internet meme, but how dare somebody get the net worth of somebody else wrong?
20 billion, 70 billion. I mean, honestly, what's the difference? Either way, you're a rich bastard.
Yeah, folks. This has gone on for a while, and it's a good discussion, and I wish I had more to discuss on it, but it's just, it is an area I am not well versed in, and honestly, it's an area I feel really bizarre about, and it's not something that every time I've attempted to research these things, I've gotten so many conflicting results that it's honestly one of those things I just trust the opinions of those who have done a better job than me to try and figure this out. And my general rule in life is, you know, if you should be nice to each other, be excellent to each other, as Bill and Ted would say. And if you're being excellent to one another, then I think that's good. And if you're not, then that's probably not good. Like certain individuals within the leftist community that will disparage others because they seem to think that they have a higher and mightier stance. I don't know. I honestly don't know what drives people, especially on the left, that why you'd even feel compelled to disparage people like this. That I just don't understand it.
Punching down at people who are in a vulnerable position and passing a moral judgment where there really doesn't need to be one.
Basically. Which, I mean, that's how the world is sometimes, that even people we'd like to call our comrades end up being jerks themselves, and it would be nice if that wasn't the case, but that seems to be a very unfortunate and very unsettling part of navigating the leftist community every now and then, as people with economically left views but socially right views. Well, we'll just let this topic kind of put itself to bed. And before, this is going to be kind of a different setup than usual, because we have a lot of stories, but we don't have it in the traditional way that we set up, moving from one topic to one topic to one topic, and then, you know, having a conclusion story. But that's just because so much has happened in this past week, and there's a lot to talk about in regards to it. That last week with Jason, we left off that, you know, we had the pipe bomber that ended up sending a whole bunch of bombs out that none of them ended up exploding, but thankfully. But there was a lot of bombs sent out, and it was not a good situation at all. And unfortunately, the week only got worse. That there was a racially motivated shooting in Kentucky, in which a man shot up a grocery store and then told somebody else that whites don't hurt whites, or whites don't kill whites, or whites don't shoot whites, or something like that. And then there was a synagogue shooter who went out and shot up a synagogue during their worship service. And I think, I don't remember if it's 11 or 13 dead now, but 11 dead. So, I mean, this is how it is. That, I mean, we had the people who are watching the Socialist RA YouTube channel. We put up an episode, or not an episode, but a video about this made by JL, who put it together. And Trump went out on stage and said, it's an old-fashioned word, but nationalist. I'm a nationalist. And this is the world now, and people have to come to terms with it. This week also, Trump has said that he will, by executive order, amend the 14th Amendment back to its more archaic times, where it was not applied to children of immigrants. And we'll just start rolling stuff like that back by executive order. And there's a bunch of liberals out there like, how could he ever do this? How could he ever talk about this? This is outrageous. It's outrageous. How could he talk about doing this? Isn't that violation of the Constitution? Can't we do something? I think, well, yes, you can do something, but not within your liberal ideology of where you think we can just hold up some signs and now things are going to get better. Signs, unfortunately, don't do it. Mass movements, protests in the streets, showing that you're actually upset and agitated and not doing a quote-unquote general strike with your PTO. That would be a good first step. But this is the problem, that we have a Democratic Party, the opposition party. You know what happened? The senior senator from Indiana, after being told that Trump, in a debate setting, I think it was actually the debate forum moderator who asked him the question, because it was real recent. It was like lining up real good with it. And he basically said, show me the legislation. I don't think he should do an executive order, but if I was drawn some legislation, I could vote on it. He is a senior senator in the Democratic Party, and he's here saying that, yeah, well, you know, I don't want the president to unilaterally do it, but we could look into doing it for, you know, Congress. And this is the world. This is the world we live in. This is exactly the world we live in, that people thought that it would take years and years for us to get to this point, and no, it doesn't take years and years because it's been boiling under the surface for decades. And now there is somebody speaking their mind. And, you know, here in my home state of Kansas, we've got militiamen who were looking at bombing a majority immigrant apartment complex, and they blamed Trump's rhetoric for it.
Worse, it was refugees. It's what's happening now is that the fascists are beginning to say the quiet part loud. They're beginning to be overt in their ideology. They're not dog whistling anymore. They're just saying what they mean. And what they mean is that they don't want non-white people to be citizens. They don't want non-whites to be citizens. They don't want trans people to exist. They don't want, you know, to be limited by Congress. They want to be able to enact their will through the mechanisms of the state. You know, they want to send, you know, 5,000 or 15,000, whatever it's come to numbers, to the border to point guns at asylum seekers fleeing war-torn countries that were ravaged by wars that we precipitated, that we have funded. And these refugees coming to our shore are going to be met with military force to be prevented from even seeking asylum, as is their legal right. This is something that I've been expecting for a while, but I thought it would take much longer before we got to the point of actually having almost an Israel-Palestine situation on North America, where we have people, you know, where you have a majority white population pointing guns across a wall at a minority population. And it is frightening that we've come here so fast, and I don't think that anyone is ready. I don't think that the liberals are ready. I don't think that the left is ready. I don't think DSA is ready, or PSL. I don't think SRA is ready. Things are moving so quickly at this point. I really feel like we're right there. You know, this is 1932. Our Reichstag fire might be just around the corner. And, you know, there's a reason that we do what we do at SRA, and we encourage people to get armed, and we encourage people to teach other people how to use guns, and to encourage people to learn how to use guns, because we really might need it in the future. Because, you know, this birthright citizenship thing, the take I've been getting hearing from liberals hasn't been so much, oh, how could Trump do this? What I've been getting is more, oh, Trump can't do that. Trump can't do that. It's in the Constitution. It's written right there. That's what it says. Trump can't change that. And they're right. Trump can't change that. He does not have the legal authority to do so. But he does have the power to do it anyway. If ICE and DHS and all his little Homeland Security goons and the FBI are willing to accept his word as law and end birthright citizenship, then birthright citizenship is ended. It doesn't matter what anyone else says. It doesn't matter how much he gets scolded by Barack or by Hillary. It doesn't matter if you know, Rand Paul or Paul Ryan or, you know, Pyle Ron or whatever their fucking names are, stand up on the podium and say, oh, this is improper. It doesn't matter. If it goes to the Supreme Court, I mean, do you really think Kavanaugh is going to vote against this? Do you think Kavanaugh is going to shut down the end of birthright citizenship? You know, do you think Roberts will do that? I think Roberts might make a speech, but I think that they would go along with it and they'd undermine it. And even if the court did strike down Trump's executive order and said, no, birthright citizenship is in the Constitution, this could very easily go to an Andrew Jackson type of situation where Trump says, Roberts has made his decision, now let him enforce it. What are they going to do? Tell the U.S. Marshals to arrest the president? It's not going to happen. If Trump wants to end birthright citizenship, he can do it. That's what fascists do. They push state power to the very, you know, to the very limits, as far as they can push their power under the law, and then they go a step further. And that's how fascism starts. That's how dictatorship starts. That's how the rule of law breaks down and the liberal ideology falls prey to itself as the nonviolent pacifistic protest methods that they've adopted over the last century completely fail to stop the jackbooted thugs that are going to haul their friends and family away to the camps. Because the liberals, of course, the white ones, are going to be fine. And deep down, they know it. So, buy a gun. Join the Socialist Rifle Association. Meet your comrades. Learn how to shoot. That's what we're here for. That's what we're doing, and we're going to do it as long as we can. You know, I hate to sound so dire and so apocalyptic, but this could be happening, and we need to be prepared, because someone has to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's really gotten to that point now. It really has gotten to that point. I don't know. It's a scary situation, and not everyone in Nazi Germany was in the camps. Only, you know, the folks that we could live without, basically, is that people tell themselves, well, it's not me. At least it's not me. At least I can keep my head down. And, you know, people have to be careful that I'm not here to say that, well, the time to rise up in the streets and, you know, make it like it's 1917 again. Because guess what? If you did that right now, f***ing Predator drone would take you out immediately. That would basically just ensure an even further fascist clampdown. It would ensure the rule of law breaks down even more, which is why things like the SRA exist. Which is why when you listen to our friends Brett and Bones on the Guillotine, or Rev Left, or any of their other platforms, community defense and dual power. This is something we just cannot emphasize enough. That the thing is about fascism is it cannot sustain itself. Fascism is capitalism in decay, and capitalism decays because it is built upon inherent contradictions. Fascism is just a continuation of those contradictions. And so either dissolves in upon itself and there is a capitalist restoration and we see return to social democracy, or it devolves even further into barbarism and just becomes basically feudal states, more or less, fiefdoms scattered around and warlords ravaging the land. But there being the thing, because fascism is built on contradictions and because fascism is not sustainable, having dual power structures in place to survive the onslaught, to keep your friends and your family and your comrades safe and cared for and protected and fed, that is what becomes important. Because the thing is, it doesn't start with the camps. That's not how this starts. Though we already have a lot of camps. Let's not get that wrong. How it starts is the removal of bureaucracy. And you know, everyone thinks of the bureaucracy as the DMV, and everyone thinks of it as a very negative thing. And there is a lot to be said about the bureaucracy we find in America, and just how much we have and how inhospitable it is to getting anything done. But bureaucracy wasn't always a bad word. Back in the 1700s, it was actually a positive word, because when you lived in a monarchy, there was no bureaucracy. Your bureaucracy was, there was a king who was in a very tense relationship with his lords, and then those lords employed private militaries and tax collectors. That was the bureaucracy. It's a very simple one, and you couldn't really get things done. There wasn't somebody you could go register a complaint with to say that the canal has broke. These things are important for society to function, modern society at least. As such, how it begins is the removal from the bureaucracy, and we see this with the transgender community, with what we discussed previously of Trump redefining, and of course people say, well, it's not Trump, it's the Department of Health and Human Services, and yeah, probably not Trump, it's probably Pence. Like I said previously, it's probably Pence showing his face in this, but still the Trump administration, still the guy at the top who can at any time pick up the phone and say, drop this, and they will drop it, because that's how that works. The executive branch is overseen by the president, and the president has broad authority to direct the executive branch to do whatever he or she basically wants. But the thing is that, so let's take this, if the Department of Health continues on like it does and defines folks' gender as what their chromosomes are, first of all, it's going to exclude intersex individuals. It's going to exclude folks that have one chromosome, three chromosomes, four chromosomes, however many chromosomes you want to have. Basically, this is the beginning of how you start stripping people out of the system. Because, well, if you're presenting identity, if what you've realized you identify as yourself and you go forward with that, well, now you can't get it updated on your passport. So you say you want to go take a trip down to Mexico or somewhere else, and you go to the border. Well, your passport is controlled by the federal government, and the federal government doesn't recognize that you've transitioned.
So having a non-matching ID is something that I've dealt with as a trans woman, and there's a couple of different aspects to it, because in some respects, it's very much... It can be a very dehumanizing experience when you're put in a situation where someone just looks at you and they don't know what you are. They don't know, you know, what to make of you. And people tend to treat you worse. They treat you like an object in those situations that needs to be dealt with rather than a person with, you know, expression and feelings and sympathies and everything else. And, you know, that sucks, but that's just a part of the trans experience. But what's worse with the, as Alex said, the cutting of bureaucracy and the with the removal of bureaucracy and the greater reliance on the tools of the state, what you're going to see is that what things that were previously handled through what you'd call soft power, through social interactions, through bureaucratic systems, through wait times and paperwork and just social conventions, things that were previously handled through soft power are going to be handled through hard power. You know, when you don't fit into the system uses, can't use its own tools to manage you. It has to use external tools. It has to use physical tools, which means that there is a man who will threaten violence if you don't do what he says. And that's really what it comes down to. You know, I've gone through the airport and I always have trouble with my ID or going through the body scanner, or there's always something that's wrong. And what ends up happening is I end up getting hand screened, and there's a guy with a gun on his belt who's big and burly and looking down at me, and I have to do exactly what he says or I'm going to get dragged to the ground, tased, and dragged off to a holding cell, because the soft power of bureaucracy is no longer has any authority in that space, so it has to be handed over to the power of a strong man with a gun. And that's what it comes down to. When fascism strips away the bureaucracy, it removes soft power tools and soft power ways of dealing with things and forces the state to rely on direct threats of physical violence to enforce the state's will. And, you know, because the soft power of the bureaucracy is less powerful, it's less reliable, you know, people can game the system, people can work around it, people can do things you don't want them to do, and, oh, there's judges that get in the way. No. The fascist doesn't like that. The fascist says, I'm going to put a gun in your face and you're going to do what I tell you to do or else. And that's really the core of it. Because with whether it's, you know, getting rid of, you know, birthright citizenship, you get rid of that citizenship for millions of people, probably retroactively if Trump is going to do it, then those people will now no longer have illegal status, which will allow them access to the bureaucracy. They're going to be handled by strong men with guns. When you define trans people out of existence and they interact in situations that require identity cards that don't match their physical appearance, or they engage in behaviors like using the quote wrong bathroom, that will no longer be corrected by social conventions or courts or agreements or anything else. It'll be resolved by men with guns. You know, when we've eliminated the asylum process at the border, you know, with the child separations, with this, you know, small army task force of 5,000 men going down to the border, which, by the way, 5,000 men is equal to the combined total of men that we have in Syria and Iraq. So
15,000 now.
Is it now?
Yeah.
So this is a serious force, and most of it's for show. But again, they've removed the bureaucratic process. They've removed, you know, the soft power way of dealing with refugees and asylum seekers. And instead, they're going to be met with strong men with guns. And that's what fascism is. And if you're not in a position, if you're in a position where you're not being targeted and you don't see those strong men with guns, then yeah, everything's going to look like it's fine because you fit into the parts of the system that still exist and still function. And you're not in the parts that have been peeled back and been left to simply be enforced by sheer physical power and threat. You know, that's what fascism is. It's forcing vulnerable people to suffer under state violence while the comfortable majority reaps the economic benefits caused by the redistribution of their property.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that, it's a very, very grim, very dire situation, and maybe it wakes people up. Maybe it wakes people up and we pull ourselves back from the precipice. But at the same time, you know, I won't go into particulars because I don't feel that this is the place, nor do we need to go into particulars for that of who said what and what was said where and wherever. But I have heard on good sources that the left is still not prepared for this, that the leadership on the American left is not, maybe the PSL, I don't know. I don't know much about the PSL because they are a very secretive, very tight bunch. I mean, being Marxist-Leninists, they probably have a better outlook on this than other organizations, but the American left is not prepared for what could very well be happening. And we see to the south, our comrades in Brazil, that folks are going underground there because Bolsonaro has won, and he has promised a purge of the left. He has promised a purge of the LGBT community. He has promised a purge of the indigenous peoples. He has promised that not a single acre of land will be earmarked or set aside for the indigenous peoples in Brazil. And this is what fascism is. This is a leader looking to return to a military dictatorship. And we have folks here in America who seem to think that it's all for the better and it'll all blow over, or that it's just a passing fad and that these things aren't that bad, or that, you know, the Proud Boys are just outliers, they're just extremists, or that these bombers and these shooters, well, yeah, they're motivated by Trump, but they're just already loose cannons. And don't you know that this guy was homeless, living out of a van, and he was schizophrenic, and shouldn't we be worried about that? It's like, well, yes, you should be worried about the mental health of America, and you should be working towards providing free and easily accessible mental health for everyone in America. But I don't see that coming out of the Democrats, because Nancy Pelosi had to go up there and say that the Democrats are capitalists, and we want people to have access to healthcare. We don't want to guarantee healthcare. We want to have people who have access to healthcare. And that's what gets to me, that, you know, we have these fascists, and the beauty of a fascist is that they're a fascist. and that's all you have to know about them. You don't have to know about their hopes or dreams or aspirations, because regardless of what has led them to this path, they have decided to embrace an ideology that is antithetical to basic decency. But with liberals, this is the problem. With liberals, there's a lot of folks that are misguided, and there are a lot of folks that are just plain up don't know what they're doing. And it's this clinging to almost an idol that if we just put enough fixes on the system, if we just patch up capitalism just enough, well, then surely the free market will guide the invisible hand. And that's the thing about American liberals, is that this idea that you can just guide the invisible hand and that'll fix things out. And you don't have to, you know, control things, and you don't have to have worker-owned enterprises. You just guide the free market, and the free market will figure it out, and everyone will get health insurance, and everyone will be happy. And they usually point to examples like the 50s, when we had a big economic boom, and how great it was, even as, you know, black leaders were getting arrested in Alabama and the Deep South. Even as Jim Crow laws continued, even as all of these atrocities of the past continued, even as unions were forced to sign anti-communist waivers in order to continue to be recognized as unions, otherwise the government would forcibly de-recognize them and de-unionize the workplace. You know, that sounds like freedom to me, the government forcing you to sign, saying that you don't believe a particular ideology. Yeah, that's real freedom-like. That's a real outgrowth of the free market. But this is the problem. You have folks like Nancy Pelosi who will ultimately preach these ideas until it becomes inconvenient. And then they will side with the fascists, just like this senior senator from Indiana. They will talk a big talk, and then when it comes to saving their own skins, they will vote the way the fascists want them to, so that the man with the gun doesn't dare infringe on their rights.
Yep. Oh, it's looking like it might be a rough one coming up, so everyone just keep your eyes open, pay attention, and have a plan, you know? Know what you're gonna do, because it might happen sooner than you think.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows what will happen? I hope we don't have to see stuff like that. I hope we don't have to see the calamity that would surely ensue when the rule of law breaks down and people start to realize it. But we just have to keep an eye on each other, and we have to have the systems in place that when the state cannot help us anymore or refuses to help us, we will help ourselves. And that's how we'll have to do it. It's just how it's going to be.
We keep us safe.
Exactly. And, I mean, me and Faye, both part of the SRA, both officers in the SRA, but join whatever organization you think is going to keep you safe. Join Redneck Revolt, join the John Brown Gun Club, join the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, join Food Not Bombs, join the PSL, join whatever you think is going to keep you and your family and your friends and your comrades safe. And if you're already in an organization, push for them to make sure that they're going to keep their members safe, and that they're going to keep everyone that they can safe. Because honestly, we can talk about, you know, the state going haywire, but I don't think it's going to be the state that does this. I think the state will retract its bureaucracy, but I don't think the state's going to start gunning people down. I think that they don't need to, because they already have folks who will do it happily. They have the Proud Boys who will go and beat protesters. They have the Oath Keepers who are training to hunt leftists. It will be like the Philippines. In the Philippines, you know, the government doesn't necessarily kill dissidents, but paramilitaries do. Paramilitia forces, or just general right-wing militia forces, they go out and kill dissidents all the time. And everyone knows they're getting bankrolled by the Philippine state, but they aren't the state. They are just a band of mercenaries, essentially, that do the state's dirty work for them. And I think that's what we'll see.
They don't even have to pay them, because, you know, you look at Indonesia, when they had their big communist purge, it wasn't the military doing it. It was regular citizens. It was regular people with hate in their hearts who blamed their problems on others and beat their heads in and threw them in the river. and 500,000 people died at the hands of civilians. And so, you know, in America, I think we're going to see more bombings. I think we're going to see more shootings. Gun control isn't going to be able to stop it. You're not going to be able to pass gun control through the fascist government, through the Republican government. You're not going to be able, you know, even if you do pass it, you're not going to be able to confiscate 300-400 million guns. You know, that genie is already out of the bottle. People have the tools to commit violence, and they will commit violence, and it'll be a lot easier for the reactionaries in the rural and suburban areas to enact this violence on large crowds of minorities and leftists, because people like us are clustered in cities. You know, overwhelmingly, we are a much more urban demographic. And so when this violence happens, it's violence that's going to happen in cities, you know. And this war, because that's what it will be, it isn't going to look like the Civil War with, you know, ranks of men marching at each other. It's not going to look like, you know, Iraq, where it's, you know, mechanized armies, drones in the air. It's going to look like Syria. It's going to look like Kristallnacht. It's going to look like Indonesia. It's going to look like the Philippines. It's going to be plausible deniability. It's going to be civilian actors and paramilitary actors. And it's going to be extremely dangerous. And I don't know when it's going to happen, but I don't see a way that we're going to avoid it at this point. And so
I think we can avoid it if, you know, Yellowstone finally goes ahead and blows.
Oh, that's true. Or if, you know, if the aliens come down and turn everyone into dolphins or whatever that positivist crap is about.
I have not signed up for being turned into a dolphin. I'll have everyone know. So let the aliens who are listening know I do not consent. I do not consent.
Can they at least turn me into a cat girl?
I would suggest taking that up with them, but I mean, if you can turn people into dolphins, I'm sure they can figure that out.
We'll figure it out.
Worth noting, just, you know, after this absolutely dreary, very depressing segment, that it has to be said, but nonetheless, it's still not that pleasant. We can end on the bit of the more lighthearted note that, you know, technology is an incredible thing. Sometimes it's spooky how incredible it is, especially on a spooky night such as Halloween. But I think it's worth noting that due to recent advances in prosthetics and also the ability to, like, wire your nerves into things, it's something we used to not be able to do. But from my best understanding, we can just kind of, you know, plug a converter chip into your nerve bundle and it'll figure things out. I have actually seen reports of mechanized cat ears and tails that people are experimenting with.
Oh my god.
And I suspect it will be the next best thing at cosplay conventions. So we have that to look forward to in the future.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting one. I'll have to finally have to find time to go to a con, I guess, if they still exist.
That's going to be great. The year is 2050, and we have descended into Mad Max anarchy, but we still make sure we have Dragon Con every year.
Totally. I mean, it's really what binds society together at this point. Just being awful nerds. Don't tell them I said
that. Your secret is safe with me. Well, listeners, let us bid you a good night, and, you know, don't let us get you too down. Because, again, a lot of shit will happen, but we've got each other. We've got each other, and we can work something out. And I don't think it's going to be tomorrow that things get really shitty, and maybe we can pull ourselves back from the precipice and figure something out. But in the meantime, I, as always, can be contacted at HumvaDev on Twitter, or user Alex Humva on Reddit. Faye can be contacted at LA Socialist or LA _ Socialist RA. Probably should set up a personal Twitter account at some point.
I do, but I don't give it out.
Fair enough. So I think we'll just go ahead and call this quits. So to the listeners, don't forget, especially when times get rough, to seize the means of production.
Stay safe, everyone.